I've recently started an online conversation with someone that I knew originally, first knew quite a long time ago now, when they were a teenager in the Worldwide Church of God. We got to know them fairly well. Connie and I worked with the teenagers at that time and spent a lot of time with him and his family and knew them well. We hadn't had a lot of communication. I say young man, he's over 40 now, but this guy and I didn't have a lot of conversation over the years since we'd left Worldwide, but I knew in general the high points kind of his story because we still run into some of his friends on occasion, and we talk about where everybody was and what everybody was doing. So I had a little idea of where he was, and then I kind of paid more attention. We became Facebook friends. So then you start seeing what's going on in their life a little more and seeing what's going on. He graduated from high school locally here, went on to the University of Michigan, got his bachelor's degree from there, continued on and got his law degree. Worked after he graduated, or after he got his law degree, worked for the government for quite a while. He actually was some kind of a diplomat, second, third level, whatever, diplomat overseas for time. And then over the last 5 to 10 years, he developed a program, radio program, it's been on NPR, that has steadily gained an audience. He's been pleasantly surprised, I think, at how well that has been going. He's actually been written up in some national magazines about being one of the young saviors of NPR because his audience is younger. It's that 20 to 35 range where most NPR listeners are like 55 and older. So he's got some national recognition on what he's been doing with his program. He's married, has a couple kids. His wife is actually a member of the city council where they live. By most standards, he's had a successful life. Things have been going well for him. He's got to see a lot of things and do a lot of things. People listen to what he has to say, compliment him on the insight that he has into the problems within America through the show that he produced, or that he puts on. He's actually the main spokesman and the main person on speaking during it. Early in this process, the life that he's been leading, whether I don't know for sure whether it was late in high school or it was during his college years, he stopped believing in the truth. And he walked away. And he didn't just walk away. He's actually been very belligerent toward the truth over the years. And he's attacked almost every one of his older friends who still believe in that religious thing. He does not believe in God and believe in religion at all anymore. And even beyond that, in some of the interviews that he's given, and actually the focus of a couple of the programs that he's put on, he's occasionally said things that put those beliefs in a very negative light, and the organization, that the Worldwide Church of God, in a very negative light. Things that are probably crossed the line for most people. But not necessarily for his audience, because his audience primarily are those same kind of people. So as I've started to pay attention to him, I've actually started to make comments on some of the things that he's posted on Facebook, point out things that maybe aren't exactly true about the things that he's said, some of the comments and statements that he's made, his perspective on things, and kind of pointed out that maybe there's a different perspective on things. And really, it's pretty obvious as a Christian that our perspectives on many things are a lot different, quite a bit different. And again, as a Christian, his opinions, his statements are far from truth. They reflect a wrong perspective. And he hasn't generally taken my comments very well. He's not used to having someone tell him that he isn't smart, that he isn't wise, that he isn't perceptive about the problems that he wants to talk about. And he hasn't taken that very well, which has been part of the interesting progression of all this. Is, you know, he still listens, but he certainly doesn't back down. And I can't say that anything that we've talked about has really changed his opinion on anything. But he has biases and prejudices that blind him to certain things, and he refuses to see those as blind spots. As I was thinking about this message, or thinking about a message, and thinking about the relationship with him, it really struck me how far apart our two worlds are. It's amazing how something that appears wise to one person can appear foolish to another. How differently people can see two different things. How differently they can believe the solution to a problem would be over the identical thing. And so that's led to what we're going to look at today, what this message is going to be about today. We're going to be talking about wisdom. Wisdom from different perspectives. What the Bible has to say about wisdom. And the different perspectives that produce their own kinds of wisdom. The Bible basically talks about three different kinds of wisdom. Three different groups of wisdom. And we'll look at the characteristics of all three of those today, because I think it'll help us see more clearly what those types are, and also evaluate our lives and the decisions we make and how we're living our lives to see more clearly which types of wisdom we're using in our life and whether that's a good and appropriate type of wisdom. God makes it clear that wisdom is an important characteristic to have if you want to have a successful life. Wisdom is necessary to be successful. Turn to Proverbs chapter 4. Proverbs chapter 4, we're going to read verses 1 through 10. Hear, my children, the instruction of a father. I think that even though it's written by David, it just as well applies to us as children and God speaking to us through the inspiration that he gave. Hear the instruction of a father and give attention to no understanding. For I give you good doctrine, do not forsake my law. When I was my father's son, tender and the only one in the sight of my mother, he also taught me and said to me, let your heart retain my words. Keep my commandments and live. Get wisdom. Get understanding. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Wisdom comes, we're being told right there, from God, from God's mouth. Do not forsake wisdom. It says, do not forsake her. Do not forsake wisdom, and she will preserve you. Love her. Love wisdom, and she will keep you. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and in all of your getting, get understanding. Exalt wisdom, and she will promote you. She will bring you honor when you embrace her. Wisdom will place on your head the ornament of grace. A crown of glory will be delivered to you. Hear, my son, receive my sayings, and the years of your life will be many. Wisdom is important. It's important that we live our life with wisdom. guiding the decisions we make, helping us choose the steps that we walk, the path that we follow. It says, get wisdom. That means it isn't something that we have naturally. It doesn't just come out of us from experience. It doesn't just naturally and automatically become, the older you get, the more wise you get. It's something you have to seek, something we have to search for. It comes from different sources. In the Bible, as we go through these things, God makes it clear that there are different kinds of successes that actually are produced by the different kinds of wisdom. Wisdom in I'll say two of the three forms we're going to look at today. Wisdom will produce a type of success. Part of our discernment needs to be whether the success that certain types of wisdom produce is what we really should be looking for as Christians. But wisdom does lead to success. But all success isn't equal with God. All success isn't equal with God. I don't know if you've ever thought of that specifically. That just because you're successful at something doesn't automatically guarantee that it's a success that pleases God. And as we'll see, it goes back to the type of wisdom that you used and you exercised in achieving that success. So I'd like to start looking at the first of those different kinds of wisdom. If you would, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. We're going to read verses 17 through 19 to begin with. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of no effect. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. God's plan, the gospel message of what Christ came to the earth to do and what God's plan is for us through Christ's sacrifice, is going to destroy certain kinds of wisdom. It's the first indication that we have that maybe all kinds of wisdom aren't equal. And Paul says he didn't come with the wisdom of words. That's talking about the type of speaking style where you elevate yourself by the way you speak, the manner in which you speak, the impression that you leave, that you've got it all figured out. You're the expert. He was referring to a familiar style of speaking within the Jewish community, where someone would stand up as an authority and speak, and everyone would assume and accept that they were an authority, that they were an expert, that they were speaking truth. And Paul said, I didn't come to you with the wisdom of speaking a lot of words, trying to impress you with how I spoke and what I, and the manner in which my posture, my hand gestures, you know, the way that I spoke. That wasn't what Paul came to impress people with. He actually said that that type of wisdom would make preaching the gospel of no effect. In other words, it would hide the truth, because you'd be focused on the person that was giving the message, that was speaking, rather than the truth of the words that God had inspired to be heard. Let's read verse 20 now. Where's the wise? Where's the scribe? Where's the disputer of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? God talks about, and this is the first type of wisdom that we're going to focus on right now, is the wisdom of the world. The Bible talks about there being a wisdom of the world. And Paul says God has made foolish that type of wisdom. But he points out, he calls attention to a couple different, or three different people. He asks, where are these people? Where is the wise? Where's the scribe? Where's the disputer? And again, those were three types of teachers or types of learned men within the Jewish community that people that he was talking to would have understood what he was talking about. The wise was someone who spent their entire life in schools trying to learn everything that they could learn and then teaching it. But they spent their life trying to learn from whoever would teach them. The scribe was someone who spent their time writing out long papers, writing out everything that they had learned. And then, of course, sharing it with other people. And the disputer was someone who was very good at public speaking. I just had a thought. There was it Apollos? Apollos? They recognized was really a very good speaker, was very persuasive. Well, that would have been, in the Jewish community, he would have been this disputer. The guy who is able to stand in front of crowds, speak eloquently, convince people of his point of view, answer and knock down any question. Anytime anyone would question his point of view, he would have that answer where he would just knock them down and be able to persuade people that what he believed and what he was saying was the truth. There's an aspect of being a good debater when you look at the description of that person, someone who's really able to argue things well and make people, at least who don't know all of the facts, believe that he knows what he's talking about. Paul, through the course of this, is saying, you know, I know that you think these people are wise. They appear to be wise, but they really aren't. They really aren't, not in God's eyes. They have a type of wisdom, but it isn't the true wisdom that he was asking these people in Corinth to focus on and to look for. And it isn't just, he's not just, I'll use the word attacking. I don't know if that's probably maybe too strong of a word for what Paul was doing, but he was pointing out that those people, not only do they appear wise to other people, but they think they're pretty wise too. They believe they've got, you know, they're the source of wisdom. And this reminds me of the guy that I've told you about at the start of this message. He believes he's got it all figured out, and whatever comes into his mind, because he's, you know, he's a lawyer, he's gone to U of M, he's graduated, he's got all the success, anything he thinks must be truth, must be wisdom. And that's one of the characteristics of the wisdom of the world, is that belief that whatever comes to your mind is truth. That anyone that disagrees with your opinions and your thoughts is really just stupid. They're not nearly as wise as you are. It's coupled with a sense of superiority that generally looks down on almost everyone else as being, not being their equal. Not being nearly as wise as them. And that attitude, of course, leads to being closed-minded. To only being able to grow if you happen to stumble across truth, never being open to truth coming from any other place. And the weakness of the wisdom of the world, one of the weaknesses, is that its source is a belief and confidence in our human abilities to understand a problem, to figure out a solution, to make everything work. It's a reliance on the individual and the individual's wisdom. And I think we all know the world's filled with people like this. Turn on the TV, turn on any news show, and you'll find someone that's like that. Whether it's conservative or liberal, they all rely and lean to their own wisdom. They have a wisdom of the world. The world is filled with experts who only look to their own knowledge and their own understanding for solutions to problems. As I said, talking heads. Radio, TV, and the internet now posting their views, claiming their wisdom is superior to someone else's, claiming they've got it all figured out and their solutions are the only ones that will work. Religious experts who believe because they've studied the Bible their entire life, they can recite half of it from memory, and they went to this religious school that automatically they have wisdom and when it comes to the things of God. It's a dangerous type of wisdom. And while we can stand up here and we can talk about this and we can all agree, yeah, that's stupid, an honest examination of our lives and our choices probably would reveal that we've used this kind of wisdom and relied on this kind of wisdom at different times in our life as well. So this isn't just head knowledge. As we go through these things, all of us really do need to look at ourselves. If we can talk about the Feast of Tabernacles already, we can certainly start talking about things that would apply to the days of unleavened bread. And to start examining ourselves. Turn to Proverbs chapter 3. This wisdom of the world, I think is described fairly accurately here. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 5. It actually makes a contrast. Proverbs 3, verse 5. Trust in the Lord with all of your heart. Do not lean to your own understanding. Do not lean to your own understanding. The wisdom of the world leans to its own understanding. Each one of us, each individual, leaning to their own understanding. There's also another aspect of this wisdom of the world that we should look at while we're here. And we're going to read in Luke chapter 16 about an example of this. Luke 16, we'll begin reading in verse 1, go through verse 8. It's one of Christ's parables, parable of the unjust servant, if your Bible has headings about the parables. Verse 1, Christ also said to his disciples, "There was a certain rich man who had a steward, and an accusation was brought to the rich man about the steward who was wasting his goods. So the rich man called the steward and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be my steward.'" Now, a steward was an exalted position within a household. It was also a well-paid position within a household. You were responsible for a man's affairs, for most of the things that went on day to day in his life. Responsible for a good portion of this man's wealth. Then the steward said to himself, "What am I going to do? My master's taking the stewardship away from me. I can't dig. I'm no good at manual labor. I'm not good for anything else, really. I'm ashamed to beg. What am I going to do? I know what I'll do. I know what I'm going to do before I'm put out of the stewardship, so that people will receive me into their houses. So I'll have someplace else to go." So he called every one of his master's debtors to him, and he said to the first one, "How much do you owe my master?" And he said, 100 measures of oil." So the steward said to him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly before my master comes, sit down quickly, and write it for 50, and I'll sign off on it." Then he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and just write it for 80. So the master, when he found out about this, commended, or maybe a better way to translate it is, acknowledged the unjust steward because he dealt shrewdly. He dealt shrewdly. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generations than the sons of light. The master had to acknowledge that from a worldly point of view, that steward, you know, did a pretty smart thing. He did a wise thing from the world, if you're looking at the wisdom of the world. He was going to lose his job. He didn't have any other source of income. So he used what he had at hand, his master's bills, his master's debt, and he used it to get himself a place with someone else. Wisdom of the world. From the wisdom of the world's point of view, a great thing to do, a shrewd thing to do. But as Christians, we know that wasn't a good thing to do. But the wisdom of the world claims that the end justifies the means. If you get what you want in the end, how you get it really doesn't matter. That's the wisdom of the world. At the most innocent application of the wisdom of the world is the little white lie. Won't bother anybody. Won't hurt anybody. It's okay because it saves me a little pain. Doesn't really hurt anybody. Probably at its full expression, it's just the belief, the acknowledgement that something, if you think something is unimportant that you have to do to get what you want, then it's not important. You are the judge of what's important, whether a sin is a sin, whether it really matters or not. And it becomes your opinion, your wisdom, your belief. When you really take it and look at it in a harsh light, it's putting yourself in God's place and saying, I can determine what's a sin and what isn't and what deserves punishment and what doesn't. And I can wipe away the penalty for sin if I feel like it, because this little sin gets me what I want. Turn to Matthew chapter 10. Christ recognized the world that we had to live in. We were, all of his followers were going to have to live in. In verse 6, Matthew chapter 10, verse 16, he said, behold, I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. I'm sending you out into a place where you could just be eaten alive. I'm telling you, I want you to go into a world that's dangerous for you. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Be wise. Understand the way the world works. Understand how the people of the world are going to treat you, where their wisdom comes from. Understand what you have to deal with so that you're not surprised when someone treats you based on the knowledge of the world. And that's hard for someone who really believes in the goodness of people. Believes that people should be nice and good and fair and decent. To accept that someone just treated them based on the knowledge of the world. And it's hard to reconcile, hard to make sense of it, because we look at things differently. As much as possible, we try to look at things differently. He said, be wise. Understand the way the world works. Understand this wisdom of the world. But don't use it the way these people do to harm others, to hurt others. Be harmless. So it's important for us to understand these things, to be aware of how the world bases its decisions, what the foundational wisdom is and where it comes from. Christ understood that someone who was acting under Christian principles would be easy prey for most people in the world if you expected them to also act under Christian principles. And he wanted to make sure that his followers understood that you need to be aware of that. It isn't right to just, the idea of turning the other cheek doesn't just mean walk blindly into something where you know you're going to be in danger or you're going to be hurt and just let it happen. Paul's life is an example of someone who didn't do that. Be aware of the wisdom of the world. We see it all around us. All around us. I think, like I said, I think we've all taken actions in our own lives at different times based on that wisdom. And more than likely the results weren't good. Hopefully we're able to see those actions now as a poor choice, a poor decision, to look back on it and say that was a wrong way for me to respond, a wrong way for me to act. I'll do better next time. Hopefully we're changing our methods. Because the wisdom of the world definitely shouldn't lead the life of a Christian. It shouldn't be the way that we act. So that's the first wisdom, the wisdom of the world. Now I'd like to look at the second kind of wisdom that we have to deal with, that we run into. Turn to James chapter 3. James chapter 3, we're going to read verses 14 through 16. James chapter 3. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom, that type of wisdom that's, based on bitter envy and self-seeking, does not descend from above, but it is earthly and sensual and demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. There is a wisdom that's demonic. There's a wisdom that Satan conducts his life by, that Satan acts according to. The principles of his wisdom. His wisdom justifies all that he's trying to do. In Satan's mind, everything he wants to accomplish makes sense. It's wise for him to do what he's doing. To Satan's wisdom, it's good to try to destroy mankind because they're a threat. To Satan's wisdom, it's smart to do everything that he can, everything within his power to try to thwart God's plan, because God's plan takes away his power. And what's the hardest for me to fathom in all of it, but is true, is that to Satan's wisdom, his plan's going to work. To Satan's wisdom, to Satan's way of thinking, to the way he sees the world, the wisdom that he conducts his existence by, he's going to win. It's going to work. He has complete confidence that the course that he's laying out is going to bring him the results that he wants. I thought for so long that he's deceiving himself. You know, that Satan's just deceived himself. He's the great deceiver, and so he deceives him. And that's really not true. Not exactly, at least. He's convinced, 100%, without a doubt, without a hesitation, that what he's doing is going to work. Which makes him even more dangerous as an enemy, I think. But that is Satan's wisdom. And we're told some of the qualities, some of the characteristics of his wisdom in the verses we've just read. Bitterness, envy, and self-seeking. Bitterness, envy, and self-seeking. And again, I want to be clear. Satan doesn't see bitterness, envy, and self-seeking as bad things, as weaknesses. He sees those as strengths. the way to conduct your life, the way that gets you what you want. He sees them as necessary and just a part of his motivation. Bitterness motivates him. Envy motivates him. So those things that push him on and keep him going. Satan sees existence as every being for themselves, with no one else to count on, because the truth of it is, in Satan's world, there isn't a God that has laid out a course that will save him. He rejected God. That world doesn't exist for Satan anymore. A world where he can be redeemed, where he can continue. It's either his world where he's in charge of things, or it's God's world where he has no power. And again, you talk about the things that a desperate person will do when that's the only course they see. That's what Satan is. There is no other course for him. There is no redemption. There is no God that will save him and change him because he made his decision already. Have you ever been associated with someone who used anger or intimidation regularly and consistently to get what they wanted? The way they motivated other people, the way they thought worked to motivate other people was anger or intimidation. That's how Satan operates. That's the basis for his wisdom. In Satan's world, those are all good things. That's the way to get what you want. How about you personally? Has there ever been a time in your life where you thought blowing your stack wasn't all a bad thing? Because, you know, people did what you wanted to after you blew up at them. You got what you wanted. Short term, it was a great thing. You get angry, you say things you wished you didn't say later maybe, but it got what you wanted, so it was all good. And maybe anger wasn't your tool. Maybe anger wasn't the thing that you used. Maybe it was just some other negative emotion. But again, look at ourselves and ask ourselves, have we done that? Make sure that there isn't any part of our lives where we're operating with this demonic wisdom as the way that we act. And it isn't, I use anger because I think it's easy and obvious to see, but there's a lot of ways where this using those negative emotions to twist someone to give us what we want is exactly the methods and the tactics that Satan uses and that we could and can use too. This can go as deep as you want to look at it, really, when you get down to how much this could apply to every one of us. Verse 15 mentions a couple other characteristics of this demonic wisdom, this wisdom of Satan. It says it's earthy and sensual. And those aren't the greatest translations of the words in the Greek. Earthy really just means it's the opposite of heavenly. It isn't from God. It's earthy. It's the opposite. Sensual is even, I was even more surprised at the better translation of that word when I looked into it. Because the word, the literal word that's used there actually means animal-like. The wisdom of Satan motivates him to act like an animal. Not like a loving being, not like God, not like something you'd expect, but an animal. When the Bible talks about Satan going around like a roaring lion, it wasn't just a figure of speech. Satan's nature, his wisdom, is animal-like. Survival of the fittest, kill or be killed. There's no mercy there. His wisdom doesn't believe mercy has a place in the existence of any successful being. Satan's wisdom is patterned after how the animals operate. And not the animals before the Garden of Eden, but the animals after Satan goofed everything up and Adam and Eve goofed everything up. It's animalistic. And I think that's sobering to realize that that's the mind of this being that's out to get us. Satan's wisdom is a completely logical course of action for someone in his position. It's a completely logical course of action because he's rejected and rebelled against God. The only thing he's got is to finish the rebellion. It's the only hope he has. There isn't any one of us here that have chosen this path. We haven't chosen to follow Satan. But again, we need to look at ourselves and make sure that some portions of that wisdom aren't active in our life in one way or another. The wonderful thing is none of us have come anywhere near to the point where Satan has, where we've actually lost any opportunity for God to give us salvation. None of us are anywhere near that point. There's always a chance and always a hope for us. We want to make sure our path is different from his path. And we want to make sure that our life isn't controlled by this wisdom of Satan, this demonic wisdom. And it's a sad and a sobering story. And you've heard it before. I'd like to turn to Ezekiel 28. It talks a little bit about Lucifer and Satan. Ezekiel chapter 28. We're going to begin reading in verse 12 of chapter 28 of Ezekiel. And it starts out, and it says, Son of man, take up the lamentation for the king of Tyre. That's led to some confusion for people, but as you read this, and you read the description, it could not apply to an earthly king. It is talking about Satan. So take up the lamentation for the king of Tyre, and say to him, Thus says the Lord God, You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom, and perfect in beauty. And I didn't have the resources and the time to look it up, but in my mind, I'm thinking of him being full of wisdom in the same way that Christ was, full of the Holy Spirit. That Satan had as much wisdom as God could give to a spirit being. Proper wisdom, correct wisdom. When God created him, he created him with godly wisdom. You were in the Garden of Eden, or in Eden, the garden of God, every precious stone was your covering. The sardis, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and your pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. God gave him wisdom. He didn't have to learn wisdom. God made it part of his character when he created him. Verse 14, You are the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God, and you walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created until sin was found in you. By the abundance of your trading, by your actions, by the things that you did, you became filled with violence within. And it's a warning of how dangerous anger is. That it's the first indication of what led Satan ultimately to the fate that he has for himself. You were filled with violence within and you sinned. Therefore, I cast you out as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. Vanity. Vanity. Corrupted the wisdom that God had given him into the wisdom that we see in his actions now. Corrupted that wisdom. And I cast you to the ground. I laid you before kings that they might gaze on you. You defiled your sanctuaries. No, let's just start. Let's stop right there. Let's stop with 17. We have a being created full of wisdom. And anger and vanity, anger and pride, took him from the highest peak of a created spiritual being that God has ever created to lower than man, as far as his end goes, to lower than the rest of God's creation. Those are two very powerful emotions that have the ability to corrupt. To corrupt wisdom, to lead to wrong choices. Anger and vanity lead to wrong choices. They are products of the wrong kind of wisdom. And if you look at the world around us, you could make an argument that vanity and wisdom are the controlling emotions of most of the population. Most of this world is become in sync with Satan and with his wisdom, vanity or anger. It's at the core of almost all of the problems that the world faces and the world can't solve because they're looking to either the wisdom of the world or the wisdom of Satan to solve their problems. And that's why they can't. Neither one of them solve the problems. They are the source of the problems that this world faces. So let's look now at this, the third type of wisdom that the Bible talks about. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. I think we ended in verse 21 when we read before. We're going to pick it up in verse 22. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, beginning in verse 22. For Jews request a sign, and Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, which is to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness, the opposite of wisdom. The Greeks who are seeking wisdom see the truth, the gospel truth, as foolishness at that time. But to those, verse 24, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power is the power of God and the wisdom of God. And that's the third type of wisdom the Bible talks about, the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, the weakness of God is stronger than men. For you see your brother, you see your calling, brethren. It says, if you look at yourself clearly, look at yourself, you see that not many wise according to the world, according to the flesh, not many wise according to the flesh have been called. Not many mighty, not many noble. He says, not only does God call people who don't have the wisdom of God yet, he calls people who really aren't even wise in the ways of the world most of the time. We're down pretty low in the pecking order of things most of the time, those that God calls. Not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise. God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things that are mighty. Mighty in a worldly way, worldly wisdom. And the base things of the world and the things that are despised, God has chosen, and the things that are, which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are. That no flesh should glory in his presence. The wisdom of God, part of one of the characteristics of someone who's acting under the wisdom of God is a recognition that no flesh should glory. That none of us have a reason to glory, to think we are a source of wisdom, to look to our own wisdom. These scriptures that we've just read tell us that the other forms of wisdom that we've already talked about truly, in a very true sense, are just foolishness. People appear wise, people think they're wise, but it's their wisdom, the wisdom of the world, the wisdom of Satan, is foolishness because they don't look to God as the source of their wisdom. Verse 22 talks about how the Jews and the Greeks look for wisdom on their own terms. The Jews look at it because they believe they should be able to read the Torah, read the scripture, and figure everything out by their own. They rejected the source of true wisdom when he came because they were expecting something different. And the Greeks thought that this whole idea of resurrection and Christ, and that's foolishness. They had their gods already that they believed in. God didn't choose us because we are skilled in the wisdom of the world. He chose us because we are weak and base enough that we can understand and open ourselves up to the wisdom of God. Our weakness is really the strength that God was looking for. Our weakness is what God uses to make us stronger than any of these other things. I'd like to turn now to James chapter 3. We read a few verses in James chapter 3 already. We read verses 14 and 16. I'd like to read around those passages next, because the verses around that tell us a lot about the wisdom of God. James chapter 3, we'll read verse 13 to begin with. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. Let him show by his conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. The wisdom of God has meekness as one of its characteristics. Now, most of you probably were here and remember this. I gave a sermon not too long ago about that fruit of the Spirit, meekness, what it really meant, what that word really means. Just as a refresher, meekness is someone who's teachable and considerate and gentle and submitted to God's will. Those are some of the qualities of someone who has opened themselves up to the wisdom of God and lives their life based on the wisdom of God. The opposite in many cases of the qualities of some of these other types of wisdom that we've read about. And as we look at these qualities, and we're going to read some more in chapter 3 and look at some more qualities that are described, qualities of the wisdom of God. Again, ask yourself, do I display these qualities? Because if we display the qualities, then at least in that those aspects of our life, we're actually in sync with the wisdom of God as well. It's one of the ways that you can tell whether you're actually operating with that wisdom as your influence, as your main influence, is by whether you see those qualities. Verse 17 is like a primer on the qualities of the wisdom of God. There actually are seven qualities that are listed there for those of you that like numbers, and seven is a number of completeness. Seven qualities that are listed, seven characteristics in chapter 17. So we'll read that. James 3:17. But the wisdom that is from above, another name for the wisdom of God, the wisdom from above, is first pure, then peaceable, then gentle, then willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Those are so different from the qualities that you see operating in the anyone practicing those other two types of wisdom. They would appear foolish to anyone operating under those things. To be gentle, to be peaceable, to be willing to yield, to be merciful, doesn't make any sense. That's stupid. How would you live your life that way? How could you be a success if you live your life with those kind of characteristics? Let's talk about each one of those just a little bit. It says, first of all, above everything else, be that this wisdom is pure. The literal interpretation of that word means chaste or sanctified. The wisdom of God starts with an understanding that it comes from a relationship with God and each one of us, and only those two in the relationship, a chaste relationship, where we don't let any of these other wisdoms become controlling in our life. The wisdom of God and the wisdom of the world don't exist in the same place. You can't act based on both the wisdom of the world and the wisdom of God. That's just not possible, because they go in opposite directions. Now, you can have those acting in different areas of your life, but if you choose one course of action, you can't combine those two somehow, synchronize those two so that you can do both. It's one or the other. It's pure. The wisdom of God is pure, is chaste. The wisdom of God, the wisdom from above, is also peaceable. Again, another fruit of God's Spirit. Another fruit of God's Spirit. A wisdom that doesn't include anger, that doesn't include bullying, that doesn't include intimidation. A wisdom that makes everyone feel peace. Feel peace. And as you're thinking about these, remember as well, if you're taking actions and peace isn't a product of it, then that's also an indication that it isn't truly based on the wisdom of God. All of these, if we see them, they're an indicator of the wisdom of God. If we don't see them, they're an indicator that isn't of the wisdom of God. The third one is gentleness, or gentle, being gentle. And as I was thinking about this, it struck me how interrelated patience is with gentleness. That to truly be gentle with someone else, you have to be patient. They can't make this change, do this thing when you want it to be, because that isn't going to be the right time for them. You have to be patient and let it happen when it's the right time for the person. When it's God's time, when it's the right time based on what God knows is the right time. Gentleness and patience. And I know patience isn't written down there as part of the description, but I certainly can see a relationship there that I think is important for us to think about. Patience to let God work things out in His time. You know, in this world, people get angry if they don't get what they want when they want it. If I don't have it right now, somebody's going to pay a price. Somebody's going to pay for this if I don't get it, when I want it and how I want it. And God's wisdom, where gentleness is a product of it, doesn't need that, doesn't want that, doesn't hold that as a motive or hold that as a something that you would expect. The fourth quality of the wisdom from above that's listed there is being willing to yield. And again, these always aren't the best translations. The literal translation of that word means easily persuaded or willing to listen. It isn't, oh, I yield, I give up, I give in to your will, you know, someone else's will. It's a patience. It's a willingness to listen to someone else. It's allowing yourself to always listen to the other person and give them a chance to persuade you of something different than what you believe, than the course of action you maybe have set yourself on. And again, until I researched this message, I really didn't think about things this way, but you see that quality in God. How many times in the Bible could you point to where God said, this is what I'm going to do? And yet Moses or David or someone prayed to God and said, what about this? Will you listen to me? How about if you just try this? And God listened. He changed his mind. The creator of everything had this as so much a part of his character that he would do that. That he would listen to Joe Blow, listen to one of us. And I think that's awesome. And I think that if God can do it, we certainly should try to find a way to do it ourselves. Willing to yield. The fifth quality is full of mercy and good fruits. Godly wisdom, the wisdom that's from above, is full of mercy and good fruits. And again, we can see that in the way that God acts toward us. Full of mercy and producing good fruits. God's wisdom produces good fruits. You see it in the parable of the king who forgave that great debt of his servant. I think Mr. Collison just talked about it last week or the week before. Forgave that great debt of his servant, and then the servant in turn wouldn't forgive the small little debt to somebody else that owed him some money. God's wisdom forgives that great debt, is merciful toward that great debt. Doesn't hold a grudge. Doesn't hold our transgressions over our heads. When we're making decisions in our life that reflect this mercy, good fruit comes from it. Good fruit comes from it. Good fruit in our lives and to varying degrees, depending on how the people that we're also dealing with are listening to God's wisdom in their lives as well. The sixth quality was without partiality. God's wisdom means showing the same level of peace and gentleness and mercy to one person as to any other. Treating each one of us the same way, with the same amount of mercy, with the same amount of patience, with the same amount of gentleness. This wisdom means listening to the concerns of one person with exactly the same level of empathy that you would to any other person. Doesn't matter whether the one person has been coming to you and telling you all of their problems for the last 10 years, and you're tired of hearing about all their problems, or it's someone who's just come up to you for the first time, God hears those prayers, hears those complaints with the same level of empathy without any difference, regardless of how long we've been asking or we've been talking to him about it. We need to do the same thing. And I know that we don't. I know that we don't always show this kind of wisdom. That we hear wah, 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 wah sometimes when someone comes up to us telling us about, yes, Charlie Brown. Sometimes when someone comes up to us and talks to us about their problems, because for whatever reason, we're more concerned about ourselves. The wisdom of God is without partiality. And it's always working and looking out for someone else. And the seventh wisdom, the seventh attribute of that wisdom, without hypocrisy, without hidden motives, without a hidden agenda. God tells us exactly what his plan is. He tells us exactly how he's going to do it. Not all the details, but he tells us how it's going to happen. Most of the world that we live with doesn't deal that way. There are hidden agendas. There are reasons that they don't come out and tell you for their doing things or asking you to do something. God isn't that way. And if we operate through his wisdom, then we shouldn't be that way either. No agendas that we don't tell someone about. If we need something and we want something and there's a reason for it, tell someone why. No unspoken intentions. With God, everything is exactly as it appears. With God, everything is exactly as it appears. And with Satan, nothing is as it appears. Two opposites as far as wisdom goes. I think it's fairly clear after looking at all of these scriptures which type of wisdom we want to inform our lives, to lead our lives. I don't think I'll get an argument from anyone about any other wisdom other than the wisdom of God, the wisdom that's from above. The problem is that if we honestly examine ourselves, we see that we don't always act based on the wisdom of God. We don't always operate with that wisdom. Too many other times, because we're human and fallible, we operate with those other kinds of wisdom. And maybe it's because of a simple principle that we're going to read in James chapter 1. James chapter 1, verse 5. Very simple. If any of you lack wisdom, let them ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him. Ask God. If you see, honestly, even if you don't see that you're acting with other than godly wisdom a lot of times, ask God for it. Ask God to give you his wisdom, to help you to be led by that wisdom. At the start, I talked about the guy that I know and how he's seen as his success in the world, and yet it's obvious that when you view his life through the lens of godly wisdom, he's not. The world has its own definitions of success. They're based on those qualifications, and they're based on the end result of following the wisdom of the world or the wisdom of Satan. If you follow those, you'll be a success in terms of what those wisdoms want to achieve. That isn't what we want. But that is an important point to note, that all of those types of wisdom lead you to the end that they're set up to establish. But we only have one end that we should be choosing, the end that God has chosen for us and God has promised for us. And to reach that end, there's only one choice for the wisdom that we allow to lead our life, and that's the wisdom of God. There's only one path. And the path is illuminated by that wisdom of God. Let's examine our lives. I hope you don't just go home and forget this. Let's examine our lives. Change the things that need to be changed. Get on our knees. Ask God to give us the wisdom from above. The wisdom of God, the wisdom from above, is what's going to lead us to eternity.